Good morning, everybody. I'd like to go ahead and call you Senate Finance Committee to order April 2nd, 2019. Time is 9 a.m. With me today is my co-chair, Senator Von Imhoff, Senator Wilson, Senator Machicki, Senator Hoffman, Senator Schauer. Senator Bishop will not be attending today. He is on other business. We're also, we have in the room with us Senate President Geisel here today. We have one item on the agenda. We're going to have an update from the Alaska Retirement Board. We will start with Commissioner Tangeman and Mr. Rob Johnson, Arm Board Chair. They're going to run through slides 1 to 7. Then we're going to go on to Callan. They're going to do 8 to 23. And then we're going to finish up with Buck, 24 to 27. And we will probably burn up our full 2 hours. I'll watch the slide count number, and we'll see how it goes. And we have, for those watching at home, we have been struggling with an unfunded pension liability since the early part of the turn of the century, and it looks like we have another decade plus to go to get us completely out of the woods, although we've made quite a bit of progress. We've had underfunding from $6 billion or so back a decade and a half ago, and it slipped up to double that roughly, and then peeled it back now to back down to that 6-7 range. And we're looking at trying to get this off of the books of the legislature. Probably might take us another couple of decades to slowly work this down. This payment structure that are additional payments that are needed to ensure the full payment schedule of the accrued benefits of previous employees are significantly still impacting our budget. It's forecasted to increase plus 100 and some million coming into the a year from now at this table. So the Finance Committee not only needs to keep track and keep an eye on the unfunded liability, but we need to struggle with our cash flow requirements to meet our obligations of our past employees. And for those watching at home, again, there is no imminent danger of anybody missing their retirement payments or their health benefits. The likelihood of that happening is near zero. It is backed by the current cash flow ongoing of the state, the assets of the permanent fund, which is in excess of $60 billion, and the full taxing authority of the state. So we're frankly dealing with a cash flow issue in our budget cycle is what we're struggling with. And again, there's no need for any concern on any benefit payments or even a slowdown of them. And we have the commissioner with us, and if I could ask the presenters to try to slide together a little bit, it makes it easier for the members on each side of the table to see the individual presenter as they do their presentation. But I'd like to go ahead and start with Commissioner Tangeman, who's well versed here in the room at the table, and if he could introduce himself for the record, and then have Mr. Johnson maybe introduce himself for the record, and then go ahead and take us through slide 1 through 7, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Bruce Tangeman, Commissioner Designee for the Department of Revenue. With me is Rob Johnson. He's chairman of the Alaska Retirement Management Board. This presentation is broken down into three sections, as you mentioned. After Mr. Johnson walks through an overview of the ARM board, we'll have Paul Erlinson and Steve Center from Callan. And third on the list will be Division of Retirement and Benefits Director Ajay Desai. Kevin Worley is the CFO for the Retirement Board, and then or DRB, and then David Kirshner is on phone from Buck. The committee asked us to present the next time we had all three of these parties in town. We have an ARM board meeting this week, so it was good timing. I'll turn it over to Mr. Johnson to introduce himself and walk through the first few slides.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and Senators. My name is Rob Johnson. I'm a trustee on the Alaska Retirement Management Board, and I was elected chair a couple years ago. As Senator Sedman would well know, as being one of the principals in creating the ARM Board through the passage of SB 41 back in 2005, the board is really designed to be a watchdog and basically a panel reviewing the work carried out by experts. And statutorily, our duties really have two overarching goals. The first is to serve as simply a trustee for the pension and retiree health trusts for the state of Alaska, the SBS plan, and the deferred comp programs. The second overarching obligation that we have is to manage and invest assets in a manner that is sufficient to meet the liabilities and pension obligations of the systems, more precisely the pension obligations of the systems, plan, program, and trusts. So within the broad context of that assignment, and it's a considerable assignment, and the board members take it very seriously, what we have are a number of more specified duties. We establish investment policies. We take input from consultants such as from Buck, from Callum, from others, for input from the public with respect to those investment policies. The Department of Revenue serves by law as the staff for the ARM Board, and of course it's the very excellent product of the Treasury Division in the Department of Revenue that provides the actual heavy lifting in terms of what our investments are. We review actuarial earnings assumptions. Now that's critical to this whole issue that the chair referred to in terms of unfunded liabilities. That's, you know, a fact of life that we're dealing with. We can go back as to how it all came about, but among the other various things that occurred because of an unfunded liability was the creation of the ARM Board as a place to at least bring together in one spot a place that would be accountable and take into account the various issues that are involved. And going forward with actuarial earnings assumptions, by law, every 4 years, we do a review of what the assumptions were. This past year, we concluded that review and adopted in January of this year a new set of assumptions which take effect for fiscal year 21. They do have a considerable effect. You probably are all well aware of that. Probably the most critical single assumption change in that was the earnings assumption, which was a reduction from 8% to 7.38%. But as we indicated in that adoption as well as in previous analysis on that, that assumption really consists of two things. One is the actual real earnings, the real investment earnings piece, which is 4.88%, and that wasn't changed. What was changed is the inflation assumption. The inflation assumption was dropped. So by, of course, changing a factor as significant as that, that has the mathematical result of creating an increasing unfunded liability, but at least it's being taken account of and it's that in a more realistic vein. The board also establishes the asset allocations. It chooses among the assets, and our investment managers tell us that that's among the most critical choices that anybody can make in investments, is your asset allocation, your choices you make on that. We set the contribution rates for employers. That's a function of taking into account the actuarial assumptions, the actuarial returns, or the estimates and the like, and setting those contribution rates. We do that annually. We provide investment options for those in the defined contribution plans, which, you know, as of 2005, all new employees are in defined contribution plans. We also set the investment options for the SBS and the deferred compensation programs, which exist for state employees, whether they were from the defined benefit years or since. And then, of course, we monitor performance. We act, if you will, not because we individually are experts, although I would like to think that we have some knowledge gained, and by sheer osmosis, we learn a lot from listening to the experts, but we review what the experts tell us, and we monitor the performance. So who are the board? There's nine members. This is all by law. It's an AS 37, 10, 210, and 220. Those are the key provisions that apply to the board. We have two commissioners, the commissioners of administration and the commissioner of revenue. Commissioner Tangeman, of course, is a member. The other, our new commissioner, who is yet to attend a meeting because she's only been recently appointed, and that is Commissioner Chewbacca from administration. Seven members are appointed by the governor. There are qualifications for who can be appointed. Among some of the provisions are you have to qualify for a permanent fund dividend. In other words, you need to be a local. You have to have recognized competence in investment management, finance, banking, economics, accounting, pension administration, or actuarial analysis. You need to know something about what the mission and duties of this board is. That makes sense. Now, of those members, two members are of the general public. And what that means is that these are two members who, quite frankly, volunteer their services for an appointment by the governor, and they have no interest whatsoever in the PERS or TERS accounts. So that is truly citizenship at its best. There is one member who must be a public or a finance officer for a political subdivision. There are then two PERS and two TRS members who are appointed. And the process for appointing these members is somewhat unusual, but it's set by law. The PERS appointees, of which I am one, are presented to the governor in a list of at least four persons by the unions representing, by the employee associations representing PERS employees. There are regulations in place that describe how that process goes forward. The governor then appoints one of those people. The same happens on the TERS side. The association representing teachers presents a list of three or four persons to the governor, and the governor picks one of those people. All of these seven appointees serve on staggered terms, so that we do have several that come that are subject to reappointment and in each of the years as we go through. So the persons that are now the members of the board are myself. As I said, I come from the PERS bargaining side. I was appointed in 2015. I was reappointed last year. Gail Harbo, who's the secretary, represents the TRS bargaining units. She's from Fairbanks. Two new appointees that we have in place are Lauren Bretz, who represents the finance officer position, and Alan Hippler, who's a member of the general public. Both of these gentlemen are from Anchorage. I look forward to working with them. I've met Mr. Hippler. I've not met Mr. Bretz. We look forward to meeting with them at our first meeting, which starts with committee meetings tomorrow. Tom Bryce from Juneau represents PERS bargaining units. Commissioner Tangeman, Commissioner Chewbacca, they're the officers who are members of the board ex officio, of course, voting. By law, they are the only ones that can vote. They cannot delegate their voting authority. Norm West from Wasilla is a member of the general public. And Bob Williams, who was from the Valley and now lives in Juneau, represents the TRS bargaining units. That's the cast of characters, if you will, on the board. And I think it's a talented group that's always worked well. I've had the opportunity of attending in the past meetings of state retirement administrators and the like. And it's amazing when you see the types of schisms and divisions and cliques that develop in various and sundry pension boards throughout the country, and not to the benefit of any of those boards. And quite frankly, through the statutory construct that we have, we don't have that here, and we've got a smooth-running operation. Other critical representatives that we use, for example, by statute, we have an investment advisory council created whereby we have three top-level experts who advise both the board as well as the Department of Revenue. And again, these statutory constructs, the creation of who the board is, the designation of the responsibilities that we have, and then creation of the Investment Advisory Council, these have been workable solutions, and quite frankly, I think they're model solutions for dealing with the problems that we have. So that's my presentation, to just remind the members of the committee of who the ARM board is. what kind of work we go about doing. I encourage any member of the legislature or staff to attend board meetings that we have. With the budget issues that face us, it's become more paramount that we focus where our meetings are. Quite frankly, it's determined that it makes more sense to have our meetings down in Juneau rather than elsewhere. And as a consequence, for you, to the extent that you're down here, the opportunity does exist to attend some of these meetings, and we certainly encourage you to do that. We learn a lot at those meetings, and those who attend, I think, pick up a good sense of what we do on behalf of, you know, the voting beneficiaries who are out there. They look at us carefully. Organizations from the retired public groups look at us carefully, and they monitor us carefully, and we interact with them, and we consider it all a positive thing as we look forward to seeing through and performing our responsibilities. So unless there's questions from the committee, I will turn from the generalities that I'm presenting to you to the more specific matters, which would be to present to you through the Commissioner of Revenue, our consultants from Callum and from others.
So, Mr. Chairman, if we will step aside and bring Paul Erlinson and Steve Center from Callum to the table.
Okay, but just as a comment for the public, on the defined benefits side, the responsibility for paying the benefit relies with the state, not with the employees. So if you make a mistake and we end up with an unfunded liability, it becomes a responsibility in the middle of this table to fund it. So we've had numerous discussions over that over the years in the creation of the board, the ARM board, and who sits on it. The previous board did not have the participant, the state, at the table that was responsible for paying the obligation. And that was one of the main reasons why we restructured the system. And we also had a TERS board and a PERS board, and we consolidated into the ARM board, which is what we're talking about today. So it's nice that the beneficiaries are concerned about the performance, but it's ultimately the responsibility of the legislature to see that it's funded regardless of what happens. Okay, so we'll have a presentation now from Callan.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, you have a question?
Yes, I have a question for the listening audience. Can you go over what remunerations the board gets, per diem, travel, compensation?
The board by law is entitled to per diem when it travels, and you know, it obviously is reimbursed for its costs. It is also by law entitled to an honorarium of $400 a day for days of meetings and for one travel day associated with such meetings.
Travel?
I'm sorry?
Travel?
The cost of travel is covered.
The cost of travel is
reimbursed.
Covered, yes, indeed, is reimbursed, yes.
All three of those?
Yes, it is.
Thank you.
Okay. Let's not forget to speak into the mic so we can pick it up. We have Mr. Paul Erlinson and Steve Cantor. If they could come on up, introduce yourself for the record. Maybe tell the folks at home a little something about Callan, who it is, and why we'd be interested in having you here, and maybe a very short synopsis of your background, and then go ahead and start your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Finance Committee members. Thank you for the opportunity to be here. My name is Paul Erlinson. I've been with Callan for 32 years. Before that, I worked on the staff of the North Dakota Public Employees Retirement System. I am a shareholder of the firm. Callan has been in business since 1973. We have the honor of working with a number of state pension funds, sovereign wealth funds, primarily institutional investors. And we help them in four primary areas. Number one, asset allocation, define the objectives, make the deployment of capital to achieve those investment objectives. Number two, implementation, Once you've come up with a policy, you need to hire people, whether index funds or active managers. Third, you've come up with a plan, you've implemented it. Is the plan meeting its objectives, and are the managers you've hired meeting their objectives? And fourth is ongoing education, part of what we hope to achieve here today, to raise the level of discussion and knowledge to make difficult decisions about other people's money. My colleague, Steve Center.
For the record, my name is Steve Center. I'm a senior vice president with Callan. I work with Paul as the co-consultant on the Alaska Retirement Management Board. I also am the co-consultant on the Alaska Permanent Fund, which Callan also works with. I've been with Callan for 9 years this month. I've been in institutional investment consulting for 20 years, and I'm quite happy to be here to present today.
We have a question from Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you. So I am just kind of looking ahead. Your slide that really starts is slide 10. And are you talking just in general about the market, or are you looking specifically, slide 15, slide 17, specifically about the ARM board returns? When do you get to that part?
I have briefly mentioned that before the beginning of the meeting.
Was I not listening?
No, it was a conversation at the end of the table, and I introduced myself to the presenters. So we're going to walk into that here in a few minutes as far as the actual performance versus all this historical stuff.
Okay.
Is that what the question was?
It is. I just, yeah. Okay.
So you've got an interest from both chairmen on the same subject matter right off the bat. So go ahead and start your presentation, and we'll take the questions as they come.
Thank you, Senator and Mr. Chairman. We, in getting ready for this presentation, pulled together three topical areas. Number one is to talk about historical returns. As you look at slide number 10, this is by asset classes. Then we're going to take a look at public pension funds and what their experience has been over the last nearly 50 years. We will then move into the policy setting area of asset allocation. What sort of recommendations have been given in the past? And where do we stand today in terms of future outlook for capital market assumptions? And then finally, we understand there may be some questions about the permanent fund, and we will be prepared to address those as well. We don't have the information in this particular presentation about the ARM board. We will be meeting with the ARM board later this week, and the information will be presented in that context.
Okay, and we may have some requests also for information back to the committee, depending on the presentation and the questions. So go ahead and.
As we look at slide number 10, these are cumulative rates of return as of the end of December 31, 2018. So when you go from left to right, in the left-hand-most column, we're looking at groups of asset classes, the risky assets, U.S. equity, non-U.S. equity, income-generating assets, fixed income, and real estate, and then alternatives, which is really a category, not necessarily an asset class. You can't index or buy those strategies passively. They're only available by hiring managers. And the idea there is manager skill rather than just the exposure to a broad market. When you look at the last quarter, I think that encapsulates the sense of risk. When you look at returns in the last 3 months of last year, equity markets were down significantly. And that, go to the far right side, when you look at the 25-year history, that includes the first quarter or the last quarter of 2018. So all of those cumulative periods build on the entire history, and you'll see that the highest returning strategies are equity-oriented strategies. Fixed income returns are in the mid-single digits. Real estate is probably the most stable because they're valued infrequently and they're primarily an income-generating asset class. And the goal of any investor is to pick the right combination of these things to achieve your long-term objectives. Slide number 11 is a histogram that we take a look at 230 calendar years of stock market history. Arguably, more than half of that is questionable. If you go back 200 years, I'm not sure the stock market was anything more than two people getting together in the corner and talking about buying each other's shares. But nevertheless, there is useful information that comes out of this. If you look at the tallest column, the most frequently occurring annual return is from 0 to 10%. And when you look at that, it's got the shape of a bell, the normal bell curve distribution. The extreme outcomes, either very high or very low, don't happen that often, but they do in fact happen. You'll see that 2008 was one of those years. The stock market was down 37%. But there's a skew towards stock market returns being positive. Roughly 3 out of 4 years. In the last 10 years, 2008 was the only time there was a negative return, and arguably, based on history, there should have been two other negative returns in that period. So it's been a relatively benign kind of market over the last few years in the stock market. But as you see, they can be high or they can be low, but they tend to be in the low single digits positive.
So if we could just stop there, and you just mentioned on slide 11 that the last few years have been fairly robust returns, and this little bell-shaped graph looks like it kind of evens out. So is there expectations that we're going to stay in a robust market, or we're going to revert back to the averages and get caught up with the average weighting over the last 100 and some years since 1925?
Mr. Chairman, it's our intent to be honest and straightforward here. And when we take a look into the future, it's opinion. Looking at history, we would say we would expect lower returns, and in fact, over the last decade, after the calendar year 2009, where there was a significant recovery, we've been expecting interest rates to go up, basically my working life. Since the early 80s, when Chairman Volcker at the Federal Reserve raised interest rates have been getting lower and lower and lower every year. And the challenge to investors is that when you take a look at buying riskier assets, the first thing you go is, what is the safest return that I can get? And that's in cash. You put a dollar in, you hope to get a dollar back. With equities, as we've seen in this chart, you might lose 30% of your money in 1 year. And the question then becomes, how long am I willing to put that capital at work? And the longer you're willing to let that capital work, the more risk you can take, hoping that in exchange for higher risk, you will achieve a higher return over that longer time period. Your time period is short. You can't take risk. And so you end up with a portfolio that has less risky assets and a lower return assumption. And that's earlier I had mentioned that there are these four principles about time horizon, liquidity requirements, return objective, and risk. As interest rates go up, you don't need to take as much risk with higher returning assets. And the challenge becomes, what's the right mix to do that? What we are saying, and we'll get into this in a few more slides, is we believe that based on history, returns are going to be lower than the historical averages, but they are gradually rising to what we call equilibrium rates. When you look at slide number 10, that's closer to that 25-year history. That includes a couple of market declines, the 2000, 2001, 2002. Markets were down collectively about 37% over those 3 years. So somebody that needed money in 3 years, if they would have invested that dollar at the beginning of 2000, they would have had 67 cents left 3 years later. So bad returns don't just happen 1 out of 4 times. We've seen in our working lives they can happen over a 3-year period consecutively. But as interest rates rise, you can get stable income without having to take riskier assets. Cash returns zero. That doesn't help somebody that's got a 7.5% objective. They have to get something that's above 7.5 to get the average return up there, and that's what asset allocation is about.
I see on this slide, before you go on, slide number 11, I wasn't aware that there was any active markets in 1791.
Don't remember?
In fact, I'm under the impression that the active markets were actually started in the mid-1920s. So how do you extrapolate data for over 100 years in this chart that where there was no active markets and there was no much of an ability to measure it? Can you explain why that data is in this chart?
Your point is well taken. I worked at a college radio station in the late 70s, and if there was 10 million shares traded, that was a big trading day in the markets. Now there are strategies that make decisions on nanoseconds. Back 100 years ago, information wasn't publicly available. So there were fewer exchanges, but the principle of an individual with capital to put it at risk, what were their opportunities? And so this measures the riskiness of opportunity sets that were available at that point in time. And just intuitively, we know that stock market prices go up and down a lot. The strange thing is that over the last decade, they've been fairly consistently positive. And that is the thing that I take away from this, is that's the unusual aspect of this chart. Not necessarily how the markets worked 100 or 200 years ago, but the fact that over the last decade they've been pretty consistently positive.
Yeah, we'll go on. And just the information in the 1800s doesn't have much relevancy in the historical data from what I've ever seen. So, and I think the ability to measure it is questionable. So we'll go on to slide number 12.
Slide number 12, if there was only one slide in this presentation, this is the one that I would refer to your attention, Mr. Chairman and committee members. As you look at this chart, what we're measuring are the rolling 10-year returns of a broad universe of public pension funds. Not just those that work with Callan, but their publicly available information that we have compiled. If you look at that pie chart on the far left, right above 1985, the average public pension fund in 1985 invested in U.S. stocks and U.S. bonds in roughly equal measure. And the 10-year return as of 1985 for the average pension fund was over 10%. And then as you look at those pie charts, we show you how public pension funds have progressively gotten more complex investment structures. They've added asset classes. And through the decade of the 90s, from the late 80s until the first market crash in 2000, the average public pension fund had returns that were in the low double digits. And to your point earlier, Mr. Chairman, when you take a look at the way things worked in the past informs the behavior that people take at that time. Money was falling out of the trees for institutional investors from the mid-80s after Paul Volcker brought inflation under control until the telecom bubble burst in 2000. And so appetites for risk were tremendous. And you'll see that the asset allocation of the average public pension fund group progressively more complex. And I would also make the note that every additional asset class that was brought in was typically done at a higher management fee. So the costs of these programs went up. The returns were very robust. In fact, that's when a lot of benefit increases and spending policies went up, based on the assumption that those returns would hold. When we take a look at this entire 43-year history, through the end of 2018, you'll see in the right-hand side there's a dotted line. The average 10-year return was over 9% a year. You'll see that vertical line right around 2009. That's the end of the global financial crisis when the market started to correct. Before that time, the average pension fund had a return above 10%. Since that time, the box in the upper right, the average public pension fund's 10-year return over the last decade or so has been less than 6. And that's a new environment that we're in when people are evaluating investment programs. And you'll also see that the structure of these programs have gotten progressively more complex in order to find assets that will deliver higher expected returns. Are there any questions before we move on?
I got a couple. So in the years of 2010, 2015 that are reported on here, do you happen to know what the 10-year trail was for the assets that the ARM board had to administer?
I don't have that information with me, Mr. Chairman, but we will be happy to follow up with you.
As I recall, back in 07, 08, 09, 010, we had repeated presentations from Callan with a target rate of 8.25, repeated concerns by this committee that the target rate was too high, unachievable, and wasn't going to be obtained. And we asked for bugle charts and some other data to graphically represent that, which was brought to the committee. And I'd like to see what the target rates were to reference this chart in 2010, 2015, in those time periods relative to the return that was earned. And the concern being that year after year we sat here and we had the aggregate dollar value of the portfolio. We had an 8.25% projection going out into the future. And that was the target. And we would come back the next year and the rate or the target rate would be 8.25. We had a portfolio value showing that 8.25% growth and it was lower than the previous year. And that went on year after year after year. And the point being, we could never catch up. So the concern is, where are we at today? What's the projection we're looking out at, and are we meeting those projections? And we can go back to the year last year, the year before that, and year before that, and year before that, and stack them on a chart and take a look. And it's pretty telling to the committee if we are meeting our potential expectations. I see now, after several years of concerns from the Finance Committee, that 8.25 was too high of a target, and we were basically scoffed at, that the rate was lowered then to 8, and now it's at 7.38, which we'll talk about in future. But the concern that I have, and there's a couple of members of the committee that were sitting at this table at the time, three of us actually, that went through that whole scenario. So there is some concern on what is presented to the committee, and you know what our results are. And quite frankly, it's nice to see the historical public trust asset allocation returns, but we're really interested in what's the returns of the portfolio we're responsible for and that we have to backstop. Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you. I'd like to build upon Chair Stedman's comments. I was going to wait until slide 13. We talked about the 5-year return, 10-year, 5-year, I'll ask now. This Finance 101 is fine, but this is a slightly more sophisticated committee, and we want specific information on the ARM board, not general trends. Ideally, when we had an earlier presentation when and the the comments were when we dropped from an 8% return estimate to, I believe, what, 7.38 or whatever it was, it triggered, our payments went up quite a bit. So I think what would be helpful is to look either at a 10-year return or a 5-year return, and you look at chunks for the last 5 years or for the last 25 years. So this 5-year chunk, actual returns were 6%. And then you'd move a year. This next 5-year chunk was more like 4%. This next 5-year chunk was 7.5%. And you go all the way down to 25 years. So we kind of have different ideas of the volatility. And then you would look at a ratio and a translate. Well, what would that be to the amount of money that we have to pay for the ARM board? Oh, it's another $57 million. Or, oh, you actually pay less with these different returns. And so then we have like a chart or a graph. So we can, when we start creating our budgets 1 to 2 years out, we can say, well, if it looks like that the market's going to go up or down a little bit, this is what it's going to affect our ARM board payments. That's helpful information. So it'd be really nice to have kind of a ratio of what the actual returns are and what our future pro forma payments might be.
Okay, we'll work on that. Go ahead and continue. Next slide.
We've taken a look at history, but if we can skip ahead to page 15. We've looked at actual results, but the question is what kind of advice was being given to pension funds, and what we have charted on page 15 are the real-time market assumptions that were being proposed to institutional investors. For example, the first observation is back in 1989. And if you look at that top line, in our 10-year forward-looking capital market assumptions when we were doing asset allocation in 1989, we assumed that private equity would return 15% a year over that following decade. Domestic equity is the blue line, about 13%. Inflation was about 5%. And the takeaway from this exhibit is, as we have gotten closer to today, return assumptions have been coming down. And when we looked at the previous chart, that we saw that realized returns were also coming down over those periods. And so when we work with the ARM board or with the permanent fund or any other institutional investor to decide how to deploy assets to achieve the long-term goals, the first thing we do is take a look at these return assumptions. And if you turn to slide number 16, we need to take a look at the risk or the volatility of those returns. And the takeaway from this slide is that going back to 1989, the risk levels have declined a little bit, but not nearly as much as the returns. What does that mean as an investor? It means if you're targeting the same rate of return, the senator had asked about the actuarial assumed return, in order to achieve that, you would have to take greater risk. You'd have to deploy more money into riskier assets, which means on a short-term basis, there'd be more variability from year to year because they're riskier assets. And that's the challenge for asset allocation, is how do you balance the amount of variability of returns on a short-term basis with the goal of achieving that long-term return assumption? And our colleagues, associates from Buck, will be able to speak more to the point about establishing long-term objectives. If you think about it, when somebody goes to work at 25, they retire at 65, they live another 20 years, it's effectively a 60-year time horizon. But funding assumptions aren't made on rolling 60-year return histories. And that's the challenge of asset allocation, is getting those time horizons for contribution to line up with what's happening with the invested assets over that same period.
So before we go on, Senator Schauer, you have a question? 16?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm very concerned about inflation, what's been happening to it, or what should have been happening to it versus what is happening to it and what we're doing artificially. It, just for my own edification, so I'm looking at the data, where would it actually be had it stayed on historical trends and not been as low as it is, and where would you expect it to be today? And that's because I know that this is I see you smiling, so I know you know what I'm asking, but could you just talk historically where it should be today or what you would have expected otherwise?
Through the chair, Senator Schauer. The long-term average, if you go back to the 50s, is about 4.4% per year. But a lot of that was inflated with what happened in the 70s and early 80s. And so when you look at the average, it's almost as misleading as it is informative. If you look over the last 20 plus years, it's been less than 3. And over the last decade, it's been closer to 2. Our assumption going forward is 2.25.
Do you know what it is over the last century, since roughly 1925?
I do not have that.
Okay, that's fine. It's just a little longer time. And then Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you. If you overlaid actual returns from 1989 to now, same colors, but, you know, just to see the actual returns, what would it look like?
Oh, for on slide 15, the return, historical return projections. So this, to your question, Senator Von Imhoff, this chart represents Callan's capital market projections for each calendar year. And your question is, how well do our projections match reality? One of the things we like to point to is that the only thing we can promise about our projections is that they're going to be wrong. Guessing what the next 10-year return is going to be is very much a art rather than a science. Really, the only scientific factor that we take into account is the current state of interest rates, given that they do have a pretty high impact on historical returns. What I would say is we tend to be better than we anticipate. We could send you a chart that shows you that information. We'd be happy to prepare that for you.
Thank you, Chair Stedman. I just think that it would be interesting to see some of the volatility as you overlay it on the chart. And here's why. As you mentioned earlier about the permanent fund, and I know that you consult with the permanent fund. Well, we have now a POMV, and the percent of market value, and it's a 5-year look back. And if it's 6.25%, then we can kind of predict going forward what the draw may be in a few years. But as you know, it's very volatile. And you mentioned earlier the 3-year period in early 2000s, it was like, what, 67 cents on the dollar kind of deal. So it's one thing to have a steady estimate in the future. We think it's going to be, you know, a blended rate of 6.25%. But when there's volatility, it materially affects our draw. And I think that's, I guess, the point I'm trying to make, is that it's one thing to have just a straight line, but then if you have the line going up and below it so you can see all the different variations, that could be helpful, particularly if and when you're going to present on the permanent fund in particular with our POMV draw that has a 5-year look back. At some point in the future, that will be very helpful to kind of give different potential scenarios of what our future POMV draw amounts might look like in different market scenarios.
Through the chair, Senator Von Imhoff, one of the reasons that a 5-year look back skipping the most recent year is used is to help minimize some of that volatility impact over time. You are absolutely correct. The volatility in the market can result in a substantial variation in the draw amount. By looking at a 5-year period, that helps minimize some of that impact. We have done some studies. We are working on a new study for fiscal year 2019. For the permanent fund using our new capital market assumptions. The last study that we did using the draw as it's outlined in SB 26, we see less than a 10% chance that the earnings reserve would be depleted due to a period of multiple year period of negative returns. That's really the only thing that could cause that to happen is another 3-year period of negative returns across the capital markets. Yes, it's a possibility, but it's a tail risk. It's a less than 10% likelihood. We will present those findings as we finalize them for June 30 of 2019.
Any follow up?
Yes, thank you. And while the amount of the earnings reserve account is important, it's less it's less of a priority than just to kind of figure out in the future what our potential budget number might be with the POMV draw, because there is, in a true pure POMV, there is no distinction between an earnings reserve account and the corpus. A true POMV, in every other sense of the word, for every sovereign fund, every foundation, every endowment, doesn't have a distinction. And once you have a POMV, you don't really need the distinction. And so to me, it's the amount of the POMV is more important than what's in the ERA, because anybody who's managing the permanent fund can adjust the mix of assets to accommodate for that annual draw.
Okay, and if we can shift gears a little bit on slide 16. So you're talking about correlations or volatility and correlations. So these correlations, they stay constant, or they converge in big downdrafts, or separate in big upswings, or very predictable, or what's the, why should we even pay attention to it?
Mr. Chairman, 15 is projected return, 16 is projected risk, and you point out the most critical variable in an optimization, that is the correlation, or how much alike are the patterns of performance of different asset classes. And because of the way models are built, you need to put in a single number. But the fact is, it's rarely accurate, because correlations, for example, in 2008, when the capital markets seized up and people were afraid about lending money for fear of being paid back, everybody wanted to sell risky assets. The correlation for assets that should have been maybe 0.1 or negative 0.1 went to 100%. Everything went down at the same time. And so when you do a correlation calculation, it rarely is going to be what is used in the model. The model is there to demonstrate trends. But your point is spot on. Models are nothing more than tools. They are not prescient. They're not certainty, but they take a look at knowable facts. They take a look at the range of behaviors and outcomes, and we try to move into a smaller range of reasonable outcomes to take from the possible, which is a very wide range, to the probable. And if we can narrow it in, that's what these models are designed to do, but they are no substitute or informed human behavior. I mean, people ultimately need to make a decision. Do I use active managers or do I use index funds? Do I have a lot of risky assets? Or is this impact, if there's a near-term drawdown, do I just lower my return assumption because I'm more worried about a loss and not being able to make a distribution? And asset allocation is just a tool to help inform that decision. In fact, if we look at slide 17, this is using those return and risk assumptions we looked at just recently. These are the asset mixes that would have been suggested in 1989, in 2004, and in 2019 for an investor that wanted to achieve a 7.5% return. Using those assumptions, for example, in 1989, you wouldn't have needed any risky assets. You could have had 3/4 of the portfolio in cash, 25% in bonds. And based on our modeling, that would have suggested a 7.5% return plus or minus 3%. But what was the actual outcome over that next 15 years? That portfolio actually produced a return of 5.5%. And the risk level was 1.2%. And when we go back to that rolling 10-year chart where we showed the average public pension fund, there was no public pension fund that was invested like that in 1989. They had riskier assets. And so their returns that they achieved were higher. If we go to 2004, based on our assumptions to achieve 7.5, you would have had to move from no risky assets to half the portfolio in risk assets. and you would have tripled the level of risk to achieve that same return. If we go to 2019, using our current assumptions for a 7.5% return, you'd only have 4% in fixed income, and everything else is a return-seeking, riskier asset. And you'd have a risk level that's 18%. And the question is it more important to target 7.5, or is it more important to avoid an 18% risk level? Because you can't do both.
If you brought us a bugle chart, it would help us visualize the future performance expectations when we're starting at any given point in the portfolio, and if you actually, you can put it in percentage or you can put it in dollars. Dollars is much more beneficial because we can actually see the dollar impact and then the dispersion of the future returns.
Mr. Chair, we are going through this process currently with staff of Department of Revenue for the Alaska Retirement Management Board. We're going through an asset allocation study and an asset liability analysis that will ultimately result in a decision point for the board. We're discussing it initially at the meeting this week, and at the subsequent meeting next quarter, decisions will be made about the overall asset allocation for both PERS and TERS, and that will involve exactly what you're looking for. So we'll make sure that that gets delivered to you for both plans.
In a bugle chart format, just so I'm clear? Okay, good. We had great difficulty years ago getting those produced for the committee. It's, I think, a very useful tool to see the magnitude of the potential outcomes, mm-hmm. and they can be significant. And if you look at this return issue here, the risk level of 8.9 to 18, I would expect a huge dispersion on that bugle chart of those two in dollars. Staggering, and it may, frankly, concern some people as the risk exposure we may face trying to deal with the then call on the Treasury to feed the unfunded liability. Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you, Chair Stedman. I mean, this is a very telling slide. Of course, the other part of the story is there's trade-offs with these choices, as in, on 1989, a much less risky portfolio, but of course inflation was pretty big at that point. Nowadays, with the national and now global money chasing more deals, it's more difficult to compete because there's just a lot more money chasing these kind of deals. But then, of course, what brings with that is economic expansion. I think going forward, what would be helpful are sometimes a national and global analysis of the different inputs, headwinds, if you will, and tailwinds of what affects the different asset choices, and then making recommendations, as in, because of these particular headwinds, this or inputs, whatever you want to call them, this is why we may want to tweak it here or there. I'm assuming you're already doing that.
That is part of the process that we go through with the ARM board as they make their asset allocation decision. That's correct.
Great.
Okay. Any other questions on this slide before we jump to slide 19? Because slide 18 is just a filler. We have a question from Senator Michiki.
Back on 17, wasn't 89 extremely unusual? I mean, with 75% cash, 25% fixed, returning 7.5. I mean, of course, it's going to be extremely low risk, but have we ever been in that situation before or since with that kind of return for 75% cash? How can you compare that with the risk from 04 forward?
There have been shorter times where cash returns have been relatively high. In fact, it was 2007. Cash was returning almost 5%. But interest rates have been driven down. And that's the unusual, inexplicable, with so much capital in the markets, why isn't there inflation? There's lots of debate about it, but we don't see inflation as becoming an issue. And interest rates, we believe, are going to be rising. They've already started to rise. In every other asset class, domestic equities, international equities, real estate, private equity will be priced off inflation and short-term interest rates. So there have been times where that has been the case, but 1989, as you point out, was an unusual period. It's when many institutions were first starting to look at non-U.S. equities. That was an alternative asset class. Real estate was relatively new to many institutional investors. Private equity was something only crazy people did. And that's why we showed you these charts, because current decisions are based on the knowledge that's available at that point in time. And then we need to use that to shape future decisions. And knowing where we've been and how we got to where we are today can be helpful to figure out how we want to get to the future.
Okay.
Speaking of which, slide 19 lists on the left the asset classes that we use in our asset allocation model. And you'll note there's the second column is labeled index. That is, if you were to buy a passive exposure, what is the index you would buy? And typically you can buy an index fund for a few basis points, a few hundredths of a percent. And when we show you our capital market projections, they are net of fee index returns. No active management, with the exception of alternatives, the other category at the bottom, because you can't passively buy those. But asset allocation projections are based on net of fee index fund returns. That's the asset allocation policy. The next decision by an investor is, do I use an index fund or do I hire an active manager? And you would only do that if you believe that the active manager, after you pay fees, is going to generate a return higher than the index or generate an equivalent return with less risk. And that's the challenge. So the policy assumes passive implementation, and if you want to get a return higher than that targeted return, that's where you look at the opportunities available from using active managers.
And you can break that down statistically and actually measure the stock selection ability and the timing ability and other things within that portfolio. Is that not correct?
We do, and in fact, on our website, www.callan.com, mm-hmm. there's a quarterly exhibit called Active Management Premium that measures the net of fee effectiveness of mm-hmm. managers.
Okay. So in column one is an arithmetic return, column two is a geometric return. You want to explain to the people at home why there's a difference between column one and the Russell 3000 that's 8.5, and then the 10-year annualized is 7.15, so they can follow that chart?
Mr. Chairman, I'm a humanities guy, not a math guy, so I hope my explanation will be readily understood. The arithmetic return is from the beginning, day zero, to the end of the 10-year period. If you just straight line that return, what's that rate of return? No variability, just beginning to end. The geometric return assumes if you go over to projected risk, you'll note that that's saying there's not going to be the same return year to year. It's going to be the geometric return, for example, with a Russell 3000, 7.15 plus or minus 17.95. So the geometric return assumes that there's going to be variability of return. It's the compounding rate, kind of during the 10-year period, what's the rate of compounding? The arithmetic is just beginning market value divided by ending market value. What was that rate of return? It's just a single two numbers. The geometric assumes that there's going to be variability and volatility.
So the easy way to think about it is arithmetic's a one-year return. The geometric is a 10-year compounding return.
It takes into account risk level.
Taking into account
risk
level.
For example, under fixed income for the short duration investment, which is something similar to cash, you'll notice that the arithmetic and geometric numbers are the same.
Right, and you
that's
wanna,
because
you wanna,
the risk is so low for
right,
investing.
But just a second. Do you want to tell the people at home what duration is?
So for For fixed income investments, Mr. Chair, duration has to do with the length of time that the bond has to maturity. So a shorter duration strategy is a fixed income strategy that invests in bonds that mature typically within shorter than 3 years. So think of it like a money market fund or slightly longer dated securities. What we typically call market duration, these are fixed income strategies that are used more by pension funds that invest in longer dated securities and that would have a duration closer to 5 or 6 years. So bonds that have a longer date to maturity.
So an easier way to think about it is the timing of the cash flows.
Yes.
That's a good way to look at it. And shorter duration securities tend to have lower risk because the likelihood of default is lower for a shorter duration bond than a longer duration bond. Right. Less time for a borrower to go into default. That makes sense.
Okay. We have other questions on slide 19 before we go on. Next slide. Slide 20.
Mr. Chairman, if recall that rolling 10-year public fund slide, you may remember that from 1985 until 2000, there were inordinately high returns, double-digit returns for a diversified When you just looked at those return projections we have, we don't have any single asset class. It's got a return as high as portfolios that contain cash and fixed income back 15 or 20 years ago. So which is right? Those high returns or the lower ones that we have today? And we would argue that it's something in between, which is called the equilibrium rate. You know, that very first exhibit we looked at had the 1/4 out to 25 years, it would roughly be equivalent with a longer term 25-year return. So on page number 20, we're putting in narrative format that we are assuming lower returns today for the next decade, but that as we go out 15, 20, 25, 30 years and longer, that returns will gradually be increasing. Because we're starting at a lower assumption now, and they will normalize as we get further out. And why is that? Everything is priced off the risk-free rate. Anything you buy, they're going to take a look at what's the cash return and how much more do I have to earn to take more risk. Well, the return on cash over the last 8 or 9 years has been pretty close to zero. You go back 12 years, it was 5%. So if I can get 5 in cash, you're going to have to give me a higher return before I'm going to take risk with a longer dated bond, or even more risk by buying a stock. And that's what happened back in the 80s and 90s. Higher interest rates, so everything was priced off those interest rates. We've started to see interest rates are moving up. So the returns of every other asset class will have to be higher. People won't use them. So as we look out with longer time horizons, we think it's reasonable to assume higher rates of return. But if your return time horizon is shorter, we think you're going to have a lower return expectation for the same asset allocation. Mr. Chairman, those conclude our formal remarks. That page 21 just compares our near-term and long-term equilibrium rates, but I think we just made those points. We're open to any questions.
And slide 20, you have slide 22 and 23 on my notes. Are they your slides or the next presenter?
Thank you. Slide 22, what we have done is taken a look at publicly available information. As you look at that slide, there are 11 organizations listed across the top axis. We have listed the asset classes along the left-hand margin, and these are the projections that other organizations have. There's only one other consulting firm. It's towards the middle, NEPC, towards the right. The rest of these are investment management organizations, and these are what they're expecting returns to be. You'll note that they don't all use the same asset classes. And if you look at the very bottom row in green, you'll see that the time horizons differ from as short as 5 years to as long as 15 or longer. And the one thing that I took away from looking at these returns is that the longer the time horizon, generally, not always, but generally the higher return that these organizations are predicting. In yellow, the four columns on the far right show the high and the low. And then highlighted in yellow are where Callan was the high assumption.
Okay. And 23?
Slide 23, we added to our presentation based upon a question we received from the investment office. Apparently there was a presentation to the committee in January that showed historical returns for PERS and TERS, and there was a observed return difference for the two plans, particularly over the long term. I have that page in front of me. Apparently, the PERS plan and TERS plan had different returns on the 30 and 34-year time horizon. So we've pulled together a chart that shows the asset allocation percentages for each asset class for the two plans. And forgive me for how difficult this chart is to read, but basically there are two sets of lines for each asset class on this chart. The solid line represents the PERS percentage allocated to each asset class, and a dotted line represents the TERS allocation to the asset class. So you can only really see the dotted line when there is a difference. So you'll notice in the 90s that the teachers' retirement system had a slightly lower allocation to fixed income and a slightly higher allocation to domestic equity through most of the 90s. And then they have really been fairly well normalized to have the same asset allocation since 2000. We believe that is the source of that return difference over the longer time period. There may have been some implementation differences back in the 90s as well. It's very difficult for us to go back in time and determine that. The other source of return differences is likely due to cash flows in and out of the two different asset pools. They do have different cash flow impacts, but we would expect the two pools to have similar returns as we've seen really over the last 20 years, given that their asset allocations and investments are effectively the same.
Okay. Any questions for Callan before we let him out of the hot seats? Okay, seeing none, thank you for coming today. Up next, Adji Desai and Kevin Worley from Department of Administration, David Keshner from, I guess he's online from Buck, should be online. David Keshner's online. So if you guys can go ahead and introduce yourself and take us through your presentation. We've got 45 minutes. There's only a few slides, and maybe you can help in your presentation with some of the previous questions if you could add to them, or especially on the performance where we're at, where we're going, and where we've been, actually, and where we thought we were going. Right. And help the committee would be nice.
Good morning, Chair Stedman and committee members. My name is Ajay Desai. I'm a Division Director of Retirement and Benefits. And
good morning. My name is Kevin Worley. I'm Chief Financial Officer for the Division of Retirement and Benefits. And online we have our consulting actuary, David Kirshner. David, could you introduce yourself?
Yes. Good morning. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, sir.
Okay, good morning. I'm David Kirshner. I'm a retirement actuary with Buck. And Buck has been the plan's actuary since 2006. And I have been the lead retirement actuary for your plan since 2015.
Okay, so we'll go ahead.
So I was just going to say our primary function or role is to help the board assess the funded status of the plans every year based on the annual valuations, and then use those valuations to set the contribution rates for the various employers and then the state via the state additional contributions.
Okay. So I think what we'll do is we'll work with the presenters in the room here, and then we'll use Mr. Kishner for questions. If we need to do a lifeline, it's just there might be some questions more pertinent to him, but go ahead and take us through slide 25.
Actually, through this presentation, we were going to have Mr. Kirshner speak, and then we would be available also for questions.
Okay, you want to throw a lifeline right away. Mr. Kirshner, your colleagues at the presentation want you to take us through slide 25. If you can do that when you're done, then let me know when you're finished speaking on slide 25, and then we'll probably have some questions from the committee members for you.
Okay. As I said, we perform annual actuarial evaluations every year to assess, we compare the assets and liabilities of the plan, of each plan, and then that helps us set the contribution rates. Contributions for the plans are funded primarily PERS and TERS is the primary focus of this discussion. Contributions are come from three sources, active participants in the plan based on the statutory contribution rates as a percentage of pay, each participating employer in PERS and TERS is required by statute to contribute a certain percentage of pay. For PERS, it's 22% of pay, and for TERS, it's 12.56% of pay. And then the third source is the what's called the additional state contribution, which is the excess of whatever the actuarial contribution rate is over and above the employer's contribution and then the active participant contributions. And we are currently in the midst of performing the 2018 valuations. We're going to be presenting those results to the board next month. And over the last year, as required by statute, we performed an experience study, which is performed once every 4 years. And the purpose of the experience study is to assess the reasonableness of the actuarial assumptions that are used to determine the contribution rate, the liabilities and the contribution rates, and whether changes in those assumptions are warranted. And we make a series of assumptions because we are, as Mr. Johnson said earlier, we're projecting benefits for participants decades and decades into the future. And so we have to make assumptions regarding expected patterns of behavior, when people are expected to retire, what percentage of people are expected to terminate their employment, what percentage of people are expected to die, et cetera. And those are a class of assumptions that we call demographic assumptions. So they're assumptions that we are projecting the plan population each year into the future. Then we have a series of economic assumptions. Of course, the most important one is the one we've been talking about, which is the investment rate of return, which prior to the experience study was 8%, and the board has adopted a rate of 7.38. And that investment return rate is composed, as the gentleman from Callan mentioned, it's composed of an inflation rate assumption and then a real rate of return. The inflation assumption is also common to some of the other economic assumptions. For example, the assumption regarding future pay increases for active members, because pension benefits are based on, are a function of average pay at retirement. So for every active employee, we have to project what we think their salary, how we think their salary is going to increase in the future. And there's an inflationary component to that salary increase assumption, as well as merit and productivity components as well. And then on the healthcare side, the liabilities are a function of the medical and prescription drug claims that are generated by retirees and their covered dependents. And we make assumptions about how those medical costs are expected to increase going forward. And that's, again, partly inflation, partly utilization, changes in utilization, changes in technology, new programs that are put in place to help control the rising healthcare costs, et cetera. So the experience study is a collection, is a study of all of those assumptions, demographic and economic assumptions. And we've just completed that experience study. The board adopted assumptions in January, and we are reflecting those assumptions for the first time with the 2018 valuations, which, as I said, we're going to be reporting on next month. And those 2018 valuations will be used to set contribution rates for FY21. So what we have on this slide and the next slide are the overall impacts on PERS and TERS of the assumption changes that the board just adopted and some of the other method changes, which I'll get into in greater detail. So in the top half of slide 25, you can see we've shown the actuarial accrued liability, and in this case, we've shown it as of 6/30/2017, which is the most recent valuation prior to the new assumptions being reflected in the 2018 valuations. So we've shown here, these are in thousands, so current assumptions, line one, you can see for PERS, the total actuarial accrued liability is just under $22 billion, and for TERS, it's $10.1 billion, and you can see the components between pension and healthcare, the two categories of benefits that are provided by PERS and TERS. The actuarial accrued liability is the present value of future benefits based on our assumptions that are attributable to service that's been earned as of the valuation date, in this case, 6/30/17. And that's the amount that when you talk about the funded status of the plan or the funded ratio, the denominator of that ratio or funded status is the actuarial accrued liability. And that's also what is used to set the contribution rate. So that's why we're focusing on the actuarial accrued liability. There are other liability measures, but the actuarial accrued liability drives the funded ratios and the contribution rates. So the first thing we did was we isolated how did the actuarial accrued liability at 6/30/17 change when we reflect the new assumptions. And on the next slide, I'm going to go into break down some of the main sources or which assumptions caused the largest increase. But certainly, as we would have expected, lowering the interest rate assumption from 8% to 7.38% was the primary driver of the increase in the actuarial accrued liability. And the reason why the accrued liability goes up when the discount rate or the interest rate assumption goes down is because If we're only assuming invested assets are going to earn on average 7.38% per year, that means we have to set aside more today to provide the same benefits over time. And just a step back, let me emphasize that the actuarial assumption, the overall cost of the plans over time will be whatever the benefits are paid from the plan, whatever administrative expenses are paid from the trust, and whatever assets, invested assets earn over time. All the actuarial assumptions do is help allocate those costs over time and determine a pattern of contributions where our overriding objective to determine that pattern of contributions is to provide as much stability as possible, recognizing that we don't have control over what happens to the invested assets, and we don't have complete control over what happens to the liabilities when we have to adjust them either up or down for changes in assumptions. But given a set of assumptions, our objective is to achieve as much stability in the contributions over time as possible. So in line two, the second line there shows you the increase in the actuarial accrued liability due to the new assumptions in dollar amounts and then in the next line on a percentage basis. So for PERS, almost a 6% increase in the actual accrued liability, and for TERS, just under 1% increase. Then the next line, line 3, introduces another change that we are going to be reflecting in the 2018 valuations, and that is the adoption of a program that's known as EGWP, and at the very bottom of the slide in blue is the definition of EGWP. It's essentially a federal government program that provides incentives to employers to cover prescription drugs for their participants who are covered by Medicare. And when plans, when employers do that, they receive a subsidy from the federal government. And until EGWP was implemented, there was a program known as RDS, which was Retiree Drug Subsidy, and that's been reflected in the liability calculations until now. But the state has made a decision to implement EGWP effective 1/1/19, and essentially EGWP provides a greater subsidy from the federal government, and therefore it reduces the net liabilities of the plan. So when we introduce the effect of EGWP for PERS and TERS, you can see pension liability, nothing changes because EGWP only affects the healthcare liabilities. And you can see the in line 3, the second line there, PERS liabilities decreased by a little over $500 million and TERS by about $200 million. Now, keep in mind, these are all estimates as of 6/30/17. We are refining, as part of our 2018 valuation, we are refining the EGWP effects and are based on preliminary information that we've received from the from your other service providers. We believe the effect of EGWP will actually be lower than, will be higher, a greater reduction in liability than we're showing here. Before I move on to the second half, the bottom half of slide 25, are there any questions about what I've just discussed?
Yes, but go ahead and take us to the slide, and then we'll get, then we'll go through the questions.
Okay. So the other byproduct of our valuation is calculation of the additional state contributions. And as I said, when we calculate the, there are two components to the contribution rate. There's the cost of benefits accruing in the current year as active employees earn one more year of service toward their pension. There's a cost of those benefits, and that's one component of the contribution rate. The second component, which is the largest component, is the funding of the unfunded liability. The amortization of the unfunded liability. And starting in 2014, the statutes required that unfunded liability for both PERS and TERS be funded or amortized over a closed 25-year period that started in 2014 and therefore will go through 2039. So as of 6/30/18, we're 4 years into that schedule, which means we have 21 years left to amortize that that unfunded liability per the statutes. And as part of the experience study, we worked with the board to consider modifying the way that the unfunded liability is being amortized, and the primary reason for introducing a change was to help minimize the potential volatility in those additional state contributions. And let me give you a very hypothetical example to try and emphasize the importance of the volatility. Suppose we're in 2035 and we have an absolutely horrible investment performance year and assets decline by 20 or 30%. Well, under the current method of funding that unfunded liability, that drop in assets in 2035 would create a huge spike in the unfunded liability. And we would, at that point, we would have only 4 or 5 more years to fund that that shortfall or that increase in the shortfall because of that closed 25-year period that ends in 2039. That would cause a considerable increase in the additional state contributions for those remaining 4 or 5 years. And because of the state's need to budget as best you can, as predictably as possible, we suggested a modification of the amortization method or period, and we introduced what's called 25-year layering, and there's an example on slide 27 that I'm going to go through to help explain what 25-year layering means. But essentially, as of 6/30/18, we will have an unfunded liability prior to the assumptions, the new assumptions and EGWP adoption. That amount will then be amortized over the remaining period of that 25-year period, which as of 6/30/18 is 21 years. And then going forward, every year that we do evaluation, we will have unexpected changes in the assets and liabilities because we know like the weatherman on TV, or weatherwoman on TV, the weather forecast is never right. Our forecast of assumptions are never going to be right in any given year, and if they are, that's purely coincidence. Our assumptions are intended to be long-term best estimates of future expectations. So every year we're going to have either an increase or a decrease in unfunded liability due to whatever happened in that particular year on the asset side and the liability side. And under 25-year layering, every year that change in unfunded liability is then going to be amortized over a new 25-year period that starts from that point. So when we get to slide 27, you'll see how those 25-year layers extend beyond FY39. So and that, of course, impacts additional state contributions. Now, all of these projections are assuming that that future experience matches our assumptions, but we can always do a sensitivity analysis to show what would the projected additional state contributions be if we introduced some either favorable or unfavorable events to the system. For example, we could say what would happen if for the next 5 years our assets only earned 3% or 4% per year rather than the assumed 7.38. So we can always do sensitivity analysis like that. But these projections assume that all of the assumptions over time will be realized. So when we look at the current assumptions, the projections for FY21 through FY39 for the additional state contributions are about $4.1 billion for PERS and $3.7 billion for TERS. Now we introduce the three basic changes. The first change in line 2 is we've isolated what will happen to those same projected contributions if we reflect the new assumptions before recognizing EGWP and before introducing the 25-year layering. And you can see the PERS increases by about almost $3.1 billion, and TERS actually decreases by a little over $200 million over that same period, FY21 through FY39. Then we move to line 3. Now we introduce the 25-year layering. We have new assumptions, still haven't reflected EGWP, but now what happens to those projected additional state contributions with the 25-year layering? And you can see for PERS, those actually decreased by about $300 million, and for TERS, they actually increased by $59 million. And one might say, well, why do we have a decrease for PERS and an increase for TERS? Well, if you go up to line two, you can see the liabilities are increasing for PERS, and by extending the amortizations further in time, we are now deferring some of those unfunded contributions further into the future. And as a result, because of the nature of the 22% employer contribution, some of those future amortizations in the later years will now be picked up by the employers rather than by the state via the additional state contributions. And then if we look at TERS, we actually have the opposite effect. The additional state contributions are going down, and so when we introduce layering, that decrease from line two, the $206 million, then gets spread into future years, and those decreases then will then be will fall to the employers in the later years rather than the state, and that's why line three actually increases for TERS. It's a little counterintuitive, but that's the basic reason.
If you can clarify that, you said it falls to the employer and not the state?
Because when we introduce 25-year layering, so starting in 2018, we're going to have our first new 25-year layer, and that is going to go through 2043, the funding of that unfunded liability. And when we project contribution rates that far into the future as a percentage of pay, the total contributions are less than the 22% employer contribution for PERS and 12.56 for TERS. So whatever we're pushing into those later years of the amortizations will then be part of the employer contributions, because these additional state contributions only kick in when those contribution rates exceed the 22% and 12.56% employer limits.
Right.
So that's what I mean by they'll be pushed to the employers, or the employers will fund those amounts rather than the state.
Yeah, it's possible. That's by statute, and that's we'll see about that in the future. But we're going to go to questions on this slide, and we had a couple hands up, Michiki, but you're third, I think. You're first, and then Von Imhoff, then I'll take her from there.
Thank you, Chair Stedman. So EGWP certainly has a tremendous positive effect on the balance. Do you know if there are other ways to lower the total liability amount, similar to what we saw with EGWP, whether there's other mechanisms such as pooling of payments or pooling of purchasing, pooling of lives, things of that nature, to help us decrease the liability?
Did you help Senator Von Imhoff with that question? She wants to know if there's any pooling mechanisms available to modify the unfunded liability.
Right. I'm going to have to we're going to have to follow up to answer that question, because I am not a healthcare actuary by trade, and so we'll have to pose that question to the healthcare actuary on our team, and then we'll follow up with the Division of Retirement Benefits with that.
That's fine. You can get, if we ask you a question you're not comfortable with, you can get back to the committee. That's not a problem. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I also see the benefits of the EGWP program, but can you provide me with what authority the board had in implementing the EGWP program, and what other states have utilized this federal program and implemented it since its inception? And I don't know if this can be answered as well as...
Can we stop there? Let's do a follow-up question and have them answer those two questions first, and then we'll come back to you for a follow-up. Who wants to handle that question? Anybody in the room, or you want me to lob it on? Mr. Keshner, you're up on that question.
I, Ajay, I'm wondering if that's a better question for DRB to answer as to how the decision was made to implement EGWIP.
So we need a volunteer to answer that question.
This is the process of EGWIP began somewhere in 2017 or even before. And initially, when we did a study with actuary and consultant for health consultant, we saw the potential savings and reducing the reduction in the liability. So we brought up the ideas in front of the onboard, and we presented that was in 2017 around the time frame, and we did further study for about past 2 years before realizing the true savings. And when we did actually realize that this savings will be achieved through this program, that's where we brought this into the practice.
And then the authority question. What can you point us to the authority?
I believe I will have to get back to you on authority perspective as a plan administrator, commissioner of the
That's fine.
We'll get back to you on that question.
Right. Yeah, that's fine. We can shorten the answers, and if you want to get back to us, just tell us that. We'll wait. Senator Hoffman, you have a follow-up.
And I would like a list of other states that have participated in this program. And I don't know if it can be answered here, but what impact has this program had on the price for prescription drugs for health trusts? If any, and the end user as well. And you could provide that information at a later time.
Okay. They'll get back to us on that. Senator Machicki, you're up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First question, on the new assumptions down on the second half of the slide, why are excluding and including EGWAP stacked? Is it because some are participating and some are not participating? Why are they separate calculations?
Mr. Keshner, can you help us with that?
Yes, the only reason was to provide the committee with as much information so you can see the impact of the three significant changes being implemented for the current valuations. One is the current assumptions from the experience study. The second was the new 25-year layering for the unfunded liability, and then the implementation of EGWIP, which is really independent of those first two.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, a follow-up?
Yeah, just looking at the net increase decrease on the unfunded liability seems to take them all into account on the net. So they seem to both have an effect on the actuarial calculation. It's not either or. Can you explain that?
No, the new assumptions and the 25 year layering of the unfunded liability, those were separate decisions. So the ARM board could have adopted the new assumptions and kept the current closed 25 year amortization without introducing layering. And the implementation of EGWIP was a decision that the Department of Administration made to implement for the plans that is, again, independent of the assumptions or the method used to amortize the unfunded liability. We could have gone from line one in the bottom half, from line one to line five, without showing the intermediate steps. We were just trying to provide as much information as possible so that you can see what each of the three major categories of changes, assumptions, amortization method, and EGWIP had on the future funding amounts.
Final
thought?
Yeah, final. So then if I were to understand this and explain it to Alaskans who may or may not be watching, considering the decisions that are made, the actuarial accrued liability with new assumptions is $22.585 billion. Is that correct?
Yes.
And the unfunded liability, if I do all the math here, looks to be about $8.83 billion. Is that also correct?
which asset figure are you using?
What?
Total liabilities. Unfunded.
Well, the unfunded would be the difference between the actual accrued liability and the asset values, which we don't have on this slide.
What?
If I could, I think that's, we spent almost 2 hours and we haven't even, I couldn't tell you if this operation's going forward, backwards, going bankrupt. You know, the problem's going to end tomorrow. Somebody at some point needs to come to this committee and talk about the money. So we'd like to know what the assets are, what the liabilities are, what the unfunded liability is, and how we're going to solve the problem. That's the fundamental issue here. And when we have a projected performance, are we meeting our performance, good or bad, or are we going to have excess calls on the Treasury? So we need to know what the assets are, and looks like the unfunded liability with this new calculation is going to jump up a billion. What's the cash flow that this committee, cash call that this committee needs to be aware of? So if you can help us with any of those, it would be nice.
The 2018 valuations, which are going to be presented to the board next month, will reflect the 6/30/18 liabilities and assets and unfunded amounts. But these projections are of the additional state contributions reflect the assets through 6/30/18. We just haven't shown what the unfunded liabilities are on this slide.
I understand that, but can you give us any indication so I don't have to go get the actuarial report and read it? What is the assets? What is the liability? And what are you expecting to report to the ARM board? I mean, we're the ones that have to pay the bill, so we'd like to know.
If,
if I may.
Yes, could someone help us with a question? It'd be nice.
We're still, as David had mentioned, I'm sorry, for the record, Kevin Worley. As David mentioned, we're still going through the actuarial evaluation process. So the results, while they're being prepared by Buck, still have to be reviewed by the review actuary for the ARM board, which is Gabriel Roeder Smith, GRS, is the review actuary. So at that point, we'll make the results available.
Okay, if you can get back to the committee, I'd like to know what the market value was on June 30th, 2018 of your portfolio.
Yes, sir.
We have here an expectation of $1 billion increase. I know we used some smoothing mechanisms on returns. You can smooth those numbers if you want, or we can smooth them ourselves. That's not too difficult to do. And then the question is the liability. We'd like to know, clearly we've got the liability fairly clear here on the slide 25. We've got a potential increase of $1 billion. We're in the middle of trying to put our budget together this year, so the committee is very concerned on the potential impact for the next budgetary cycle, which will be in a year. And we're expecting potential $100+ million increase of a cash call in the middle of the table. And the sooner we know what those numbers are, the easier it is for us to put a sound fiscal package together. The June 30th number, market value number, should be attainable. And if we have to, we'll use this billion plus the representation of the liability today, here, to help us. The committee also struggles with for years, and we have to deal with it, unfortunately, is the offset in time going back, the delay factor. So we understand that, and we work with that two-year delay. The commissioner is writing to the rescue. Mr. Commissioner, can you help the committee with that so we don't go ghost white when you tell us the numbers in the future?
Thank you for the record, Bruce Tangeman, Department of Revenue. So we had a presentation at the January board meeting. The PERS, TERS liability prior to the actions was $6.9 billion. We were 78% funded. The estimate after the actuary experience study without the EGWP is about $8.2 billion, or 75%. So with the estimate of the EGWP would be 7.2, and these are the numbers that will be trued up in the coming month.
So if we didn't accept the employer group waiver plan, this EGWA thing, we'd be looking at 8.2, and then with this modification that moves that liability down, we can roughly expect it to be down $1 billion to 7.2. Is that, am I understanding that correctly?
Yes, sir.
Okay, and so we have a $7.2 billion liability that we're trying to struggle with and get control of. That is putting severe cash constraints on our ability to basically make our payroll and pay a dividend and have a capital budget and do our deferred maintenance and all that stuff that the commissioner's well aware of. And okay, so if we can have, when we previously asked for the Bugle chart and the analysis, if we can have that data, I'd like it backed up a decade for each year, the market value or the smoothing value, or both, whatever you guys want to do, probably both would be easiest, and then give us the projection of that given year. I think historically it's been 8.25 and then down to 8, and track those assets for the coming quarter. We're getting a slight echo here. And then project it the following year, and then continually to do that over a 10-year window. We've had that done before, and I think several years back at 8, 9, and 10, maybe 11 and 12 in the years when we've looked at this before, when I've sat at this table and struggled with this issue. And then the Bugle chart showing future projections of the assets, and we can get an idea of the risk exposure we have at this table when we look at the spread of that Bugle chart versus the liability issue. Because I can't tell you with these past presentations what risk exposure we have in this table at all. So we're gonna work on clarifying that to make it easier for the committee and the public to understand you know, what we're dealing with, because we've been struggling, frankly, with this since 2005, and it doesn't look like I'm going to have it resolved till I'm retired or dead, because it keeps coming around, and we don't, you know, we were hoping that it would cap out at $8 billion back in 2006, and that was just an internal expectation. And this problem is much more difficult to solve than anybody. The unfunded liability problem, to fund it, is what I'm referring to, is much more difficult than anybody expected a decade and a half ago, almost. So it's something we have to deal with. Senator Michiki had a question. We have two more slides in 6 minutes, so we want to make sure he gets to the layering.
Yeah, I'll be quick, Mr. Chairman. If the commissioner can share those numbers, might just. From my math, it looks like we're closer to $8.8 billion, but if he could share those numbers with the committee, I'd love to see those sources.
We'll get them laid out for the committee, and then when they have the new data run, the new assumptions for June of 18, we'll make sure, even if we're at the end of session or out of session, we'll make sure the committee members get posted notice on all that issue, because it's something that affects everybody. We have two more slides in 5 minutes. Mr. Keshner, I think the slide 26 is going to be pretty self-explanatory. Can you speed through that and then enlighten us on slide 27?
Yes. slide 26 shows for PERS and TERS, the top half is pension, the bottom half is health care. The impact on the 6/30/17 liabilities just due to the new assumptions not including EGWIP and not including anything related to the unfunded liability amortization period. And if you look, we have basically four categories of changes. The first category is all of the demographic assumptions, the predictions of patterns of behavior of plan participants. And the second one for the pension are the salary increase rates. Because of past experience and future expectations, salary increases, partly because of lower inflation rates, are expected to increase at a less rapid rate. And then the corresponding assumption on the for the healthcare are the medical trend rates, and those have increased the percentage impact on the liability you can see from the trend rates. On the pension, we also have the impact of the lower inflation rate on the COLA-related benefits. There's two types of COLAs. There's a basic benefit that's tied to inflation, and then for Alaska residents, there's a residency adjustment. And you can see because we're lowering the inflation assumption from, it's currently at 3.12, and we're lowering that to 2.5, that causes liabilities to go down. You can see the percentage for both PERS and TERS. And then the most significant impact of any assumption is the dropping of the investment return from 8% to 7.38. And you can see the impact on each of the components, PERS and TERS, pension, and healthcare.
Okay. And we got about 3 minutes left on slide 27. If you could give us a synopsis on slide 27, please.
Yes, slide 27. Please ignore the numbers because these are hypothetical numbers that are shown in blue. I'm just trying to explain how the new 25-year layering will proceed from 1 year to the next. So in layer one is the unfunded liability that is going to be to continue to be amortized over that what's left of that 25-year period, which is 21 years. So layer one will be amortized from all the way through FY39. And then now we introduce our new layers. So at 6/30/18, we have layer two, which is the effect of the new assumptions and the implementation of EGWIP. And in this example, I've shown that to increase liabilities by $450 million, and you can see the amortization in the next column. And those amortizations now go from 2019 through 2043, which is that 25-year period. And then we get to the next valuation in 2019, and in this case, I've introduced a new layer, which is a decrease in liability, unfunded liability of $200 million, and you can see what the amortizations are, and those would be amortized beginning in 2020 through 2044, again, 25-year period, et cetera, et cetera. So as you can see in the very last column, the total for these sample years, you can see the amortization of the unfunded significantly drops off from 2039 through 2040 based on these hypothetical numbers. And that's because the bulk of the amortization is going to be in the next 21 years, absent any significant increases in unfunded liabilities in the future. So that's how the 25-year layering will apply. Every year, we will introduce a new 25-year layer that then gets amortized over the next 25 years from that point forward.
Okay, I think we got that. That's any questions before we conclude today? Okay. I'd like to thank the presenters today. I know sometimes it's kind of, gets to be an interesting discussion when we deal with the unfunded liability and the frustration we have trying to get a handle on it and basically get it paid down. We've started this process in roughly 2005 at this table with, I think, around $6 billion. Now it's 2019, and we owe $8 billion. Some number, $7 billion. And there has been a bump up in the middle of that. So we haven't been as successful in dealing with it as a lot of us would like in getting this thing under control. So we will wait till we get the information back from the presenters on the performance, and we'll get it to the committee members, and we'll decide what we want to do, if we want to have another discussion here at the committee on the performance and the targets. I really am a little frustrated at spending 2 hours, and I couldn't tell the public if we're going forwards or backwards. And we need to be able to answer that question, and if we're going backwards, why? And if we're going forwards, why we're doing that? And it's an issue that impacts a lot of Alaskans and their retirement and benefits that they are owed by us. And some of us are very protective of the permanent fund, and we're not interested in having the employees backed into it to receive their due benefits. And frankly, we're having trouble this year balancing our cash flow. And this is part of the upcoming challenges. Senator Von Imhoff has mentioned to me several times, working on the operating budget, don't forget the coming 100+ million coming next year. You know, what are you going to do, Mr. Chairman? And so I don't know yet. But it's definitely in the conversation between the co-chairs, next year's budget and what we're going to do. And we're going to try to define that numeric for the committee members so it's not a surprise. And we will work with the presenters today, including the Commissioner of Revenue, and sit down and kind of go over that stuff, what we would like to see and why. This was a good basic layout today of asset classes and relationships and all that stuff, which is all good to hear, especially for new members or of the public. But we need to boil it down to cash flow at the table. That's what it's all about, meeting our payroll and our obligations. So with that, thanks everybody. Tomorrow morning, 9 a.m., we're going to have an interesting discussion dealing with education, data analysis by my co-chair, Senator Von Imhoff, who has been working on that, and some ideas as we deal with the education budget. And how do we get our performance, our reading, and our math scores up across the state? So that'll start an interesting discussion here. She'll be chairing that and taking us through a data-filled morning. So this was a data-filled morning, and tomorrow will be data on regression analysis on steroids. So come back with a smiley face, and we'll have at it tomorrow morning, and we'll continue working on our budgets. We are adjourned.